little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelich. And I'm beaming in remotely via Skype. And let me say at the start here that, regrettably, Thinking Clearly co-host Julia Minton is not able to be with us on this episode because she had an unavoidable scheduling conflict. In fact, you know, I miss her already because she's usually the one that tells folks how to get in touch with us and all about our Facebook page. So I'm going to do that right now because we love to hear from our listeners. We love to get feedback from you. We love to get ideas from you about future topics for the show, future guests, and that sort of thing, and get feedback from the show, about the show. And you can get in touch with us on our Facebook page. We use our Facebook page to give listeners additional links and resources for critical thinking. So be sure and check in on our Facebook page. You go to the Facebook page search bar and you type in Thinking Clearly Radio. And the other thing I want to tell you about is that we've been on the air for about 4.5 years, and you can get all of our previous podcast versions of Thinking Clearly. We podcast this show and archive all of those, and our site for getting that is thinkingclearly.libsyn. That's thinkingclearly, one word, .libsyn.com. You can also get it on iTunes, Amazon Podcasts, or anywhere you can catch podcasts, you can find us. So that's the skinny about getting in touch with us and letting you know about how you can get our podcast version of this show. Well, there's lots of meat on the bones tonight in this episode. And before I launch into the topics for this edition of Thinking Clearly, I just have to acknowledge to our live broadcast listeners and to our podcast listeners who may be hearing this anytime in the future that I'm talking on January 7th, 2021, one day after the horribly upsetting occupation of the U.S. Capitol building, which resulted in the lockdown of the U.S. Capitol to protect the safety of members of Congress in the face of a massive demonstration from the supporters of President Trump. Demonstrations which are protesting Trump's loss to Democrat Joe Biden and labeling it as a rigged election, which it certainly was not. Well, one reason that those events are upsetting and unprecedented is because President Trump's continual messages reiterating the election fraud narrative and thus having a sitting president fueling demonstrations which interfere with the democratic process in our country. But I want to emphasize that these events are not the topic for this episode. But events such as these do reinforce how deeply we are divided and polarized in America, and how this divisiveness makes clear the importance of taking actions to resist weaponizing information and to restore trust in our information environment through critical thinking and becoming information environmentalists. And these are the topics for this edition of Thinking Clearly. So I'm going to give kind of an overview of what we're up to in this episode, because it's a number of different things. And I'm going to start by describing three key perspectives. You can call them mental models, or psychologists might call them theories. And these are aspects of human behavior that I've learned about from doing the background research from this program, and that I now really find very helpful as tools for critical thinking. And the first is the idea that when making decisions and forming beliefs, we use two main cognitive approaches, and they're often called System 1 and System 2. That's how we've referred to them on Thinking Clearly. We've had shows about that. But the technical name for this approach is called the dual process theory. So I'm going to talk about that and give some more details. And secondly, I'm going to describe the perspective that the brain is essentially a prediction machine. That's a very interesting idea, very much in vogue now in cognitive psychology. And the third perspective that I'm going to talk about is how the groups that we identify with shape our beliefs and behaviors. That's an area of study called social cognition. And my hope here is just to briefly describe each of these perspectives as tools for critical thinking and then point you to some of the research that has been done on those issues so that you can explore more on your own. And that's where the links on our Facebook page come in. I have a disclaimer right here at the start, and that's that these three perspectives are just very simplified broad brush strokes, but they are helpful as ways of talking about those processes that actually involve a staggering amount of complex electrochemical signaling done beneath the hood, unconsciously in our brains, by those 85 to 100 million neurons in the human brain, all processing information about our body and the outside world to provide us with our thoughts, our feelings, and ultimately our consciousness. So here's the Cliff Notes version of the dual processing model on human cognition. Our human brain has a wonderful ability at quickly and mostly unconsciously processing information with a minimum amount of drain on our brain's resources. And we call that intuition, but in a lot of scientific literature, it's known as System 1 processing. This is part of the dual processing model. The basic neural capacities for doing this genetically and developmentally wired into our brain's activity that we do, those wired in parts are also refined by our experiences as we learn through especially early childhood. So putting it into cave person's terms, consider yourself an expert hunter who has like this wired in capacity to see some animal tracks and make associations with some of the tracks as indicating the presence of scrumptious, desirable sources of food, while perhaps spotting other tracks and identifying those as dangerous predators, and the hair stands up on the back of your neck. Well, those unconscious associations prepare you, the hunter, to hunt, or maybe flee, or freeze, or fight, as the appropriate association zooms into your consciousness. And your consciousness is believed to be sort of after the fact, after those decisions are already made and that processing has already been done. Consciousness is thought to be like a spotlight on what your brain has already processed, according to these approaches in cognitive science. These reactions are really fast, but they're augmented by experience. So you can make throughout your life as this cave person, a hunter, a careful inspection of the tracks and begin to estimate the freshness of the tracks and the direction that the animal is moving. And you could scan for scat and other trail signs. And now you as the hunter develops the expertise of a skilled tracker. This is all that intuitive System 1 cognition, built on a foundation of complex unconscious processing and honed by millions of years of evolution. And it served our species well to endow us with the adaptability to survive and thrive in a lot of different ecosystems on planet Earth. Well, that's not all. We developed in our evolutionary development many other cognitive capacities, including pattern recognition, a capacity to create and manipulate symbols, ability to make logical inferences, and other cognitive abilities. And human beings then became able to develop spoken and written language. And with that came the ability to create and sustain cultures that co-evolved with us to augment our inborn mental abilities and strengthen our social cooperation. So it's really the merger then of those enhanced cognitive abilities with new tools that are supplied by the technology that we've able, or culture has been able to develop, and the culture co-evolved with us that provides the power of System 2 processing. For example, we can use controlled experimentation, statistics, and computer modeling to answer questions that could never have been handled by our intuitive System 1. So that's the dual system processing model. The key is to know when to use each, because each system has its strength. System 1 is fast, it takes a minimum of energy, and is good at handling those things that we're trained and skilled at, while System 2 is a lot slower takes a lot more energy, but handles much more complicated problems and decisions. And here's a simple example of the difference between those two systems. Try this with me at home. It's safe. Answer these questions. Add 2 + 2. Got it? Quick, right? Pops right into your head. 2 + 2 is 4. That's system one. Now multiply 245.3 times 87.6. Well, the answer didn't come automatically, did it? To get that answer, you have to use a mathematical algorithm that we all learned in grade school. You write the numbers down, you line up the decimals, you multiply in the correct order, don't forget to carry, and on, because maybe you were pretty smart when I just asked this question and you just reached for your calculator. But you got to remember that that calculator has just been, by our technology, programmed in electronically to work that algorithm, that multiplication algorithm. Well, resources to learn more about dual processing theory, and it's worth doing that, are the classic book called Thinking Fast and Slow. And that's by the godfather of the subject, Daniel Kahneman. He's a psychologist who won the Nobel Prize for his research, which helped change the field of economics. So the Nobel Prize he won as a psychologist was in the field of economics. Kahneman's contributions led to identifying many of the vulnerabilities using System 1 thinking for trying to answer complex questions in modern society. So it led to the foundation of what's called behavioral economics, which is we are not just this ideal thing that always makes completely logical decisions based on our own self-interest. We have cognitive vulnerabilities and biases that affect our decision-making. Well, if you want to round out this subject of the dual process model, I've got another book for you. It's a book called Seeing What Others Don't, The Remarkable Ways That We Gain Insights. And that's by a very interesting guy, researcher and advocate for the usefulness of intuition and insight. His name is Gary Klein. And Gary was a guest with us on episode 29 of Thinking Clearly, one of our more popular episodes. You can go back and listen to that on the archive. And an awareness of those two systems, system one, system two, the best use of that depends on what the problem is. If it's something that can be quickly done by our system one, great, use system one. But if it needs more research, more deliberate thinking, something that comes from our culture like statistics or risk-benefit analysis or something like that, then it's definitely something that we should engage system two with. The problem is, oftentimes, those problems that are really complex enough that they require a system two, we just use our quick intuitive, quick hit, associative, emotional system one. And that's one of the things that gets us in trouble. Critical thinking is really engaging our system two. The perspective of system one and system two, this dual process model, really helps remind me to look behind the headlines. Headlines are system one, right? You see a headline, it inspires some kind of emotional reaction because that's what the headline's designed to do. Many people read headlines in posts and don't even read the full article and then repost it. That's a practice that I'm hoping to discourage. Okay, second idea that we're going to talk about is the brain as a prediction machine. This is really a sort of an intuitive approach, although it is counterintuitive in some ways, but it's popular among cognitive scientists. And that idea is that the brain operates as a prediction machine, and it explains why, for me, why it explains why one person can have such different views of reality as another person. There's a great article in the September 2019 edition of Scientific American, and that whole issue, by the way, has 11 articles that relate to critical thinking. If you're a critical thinker, I would get that edition of Scientific American. And a quote from that article puts it this way. It says, quote, "The reality that we perceive is not a direct reflection of the external objective world. Instead, it's a product of the brain's predictions about the causes of incoming sensory signals." And the idea is that the brain is constantly creating a description of what's out there. And also, of course, what's in here, because we're getting sensations from our body, too. And then the brain checks the accuracy of that description against the new sensory information coming in. So it's an interplay, kind of a top-down, bottom-up system. It's an interplay between that map of the world that we build and the map of reality that we build in our head and the constantly incoming new sensory information. And the idea is that it's a corrective device. Our new sensory information should help correct that map of what the world is that we already have in our brain. Now, sometimes our belief about what's out there trumps our sensory information, and that explains optical illusions. And we discuss this perspective in some detail on Thinking Clearly, episode 43. And I'll put additional links to the subject on the Facebook page. It's kind of a set of intriguing ideas. This perspective helps me remember that other people may have completely different beliefs than me because they have completely different views of reality. And we saw examples of that just yesterday. And it makes me curious and helps me focus on finding those aspects of reality the other folks that I'm in communication with have in common, while really trying to work to identify our areas of difference. And this is the approach that helps us engage in civil dialogue, another theme that we have on this program, Thinking Clearly. And this makes it much more likely to have productive conversations than if I view people as just ignorant idiots. Now, the interplay between the top-down preconceptions that we all have about the world and the bottom-up examination of new information about reality also explains our strong tendencies toward confirmation bias. That's the tendency to search for and interpret, favor and recall information in a way that confirms our prior beliefs or values. It takes a lot more energy to update our beliefs than to stick to the ones that we already have. Now, I'll be a little quicker on this last one. It's called social cognition. It's the idea that humans have direct access to our own minds. But early in child development, we also begin to understand that other human beings experience similar emotions, intentions, and beliefs. Now, we just take that for granted because we've grown up and that part of our brain has clicked on. And some evolutionary psychologists call this ability being that we realize that, yes, we have thoughts and emotions and feelings and habits and behaviors that we engage in, things that make us sad, things that make us happy, but other human beings have their own set of those emotions and beliefs. And not all animals have this ability. Some psychologists think that maybe it's just ravens. Primates, our closest evolutionary neighbor, chimpanzees, for example, may have some rudimentary theory of mind, but it's pretty unique to human beings. As simple as it seems and as natural as it seems for us to do that. A lot of evolutionary biologists believe that this theory of mind is what really accelerated our ability to engage in cooperative social behavior and goes a long way to explain why human beings are able to create and develop and sustain cultures. And it's this interaction. It's so intriguing for me to think about the interaction between the parts that are wired into our human brain versus the more changeable parts that come into our consciousness, come into our thought process from our culture and our technology. And that's what makes us special. And research into that part of human behavior is known as social cognition and identity protective cognition. And there's been a lot of research which has shed light on the sort of tribal polarization that we're seeing around politics and other issues. For me, this frame of reference really helps me understand how strongly beliefs are sometimes clung to, even though those beliefs aren't supported by evidence. It's an expression that our group, consistent belief, was what I call the company line, shows that we're a member in good standing of the group. You hear that all the time and see it all the time. Lots of that going on social media. We'll learn more about that topic from Thinking Clearly, episode 35, and I'll put some other links on our Facebook page. We're going to shift gears now. We're going to talk a little bit about the present state of our information environment, where we're headed and what we can do to help. So as people who realize the importance of accurate information and critical thinking to the quality of our lives and the ability of our species to survive and thrive, that is, you know, how would we actually be able to use that information and become what I want to call information environmentalists? Because we have a polluted, in my opinion, a polluted information environment, and we can all begin to help clean that up. Misinformation and disinformation has been identified as a problem in America for a lot of years, but it's especially been accelerated by the development of the World Wide Web and social media platforms, and it took another leap during and after the 2016 presidential election. And the issue of rapid spread of misinformation has engaged a number of researchers and activists who are worried and working to help understand and implement ways to reverse that trend. And I'm going to put links on our Facebook page to some of those organizations that are really working hard to stem the tide of misinformation. So in the rest of this episode, we're going to explore answers to these questions, aided by some pre-recorded insights with a couple of experts. First, we're going to hear from Claire Wardle, who has a PhD in communications and extensive expertise in countering misinformation. And Dr. Wardle is the co-founder and the U.S. director of an organization called First Draft. That's at firstdraftnews.org. Encourage you to look that up and take a look at some of those resources. I'll put the link on our Facebook page. It's an organization that has this stated message, quote, to empower society with the knowledge, understanding, and tools needed to outsmart false and misleading information, end quote. So lots of great information on their website, firstdraftnews.org. So here's Claire Wardle. She's talking about the role of social media and what we can all do to help decrease the pollution. This is a clip from the Future of Storytelling podcast with host Charlie Melcher. It was recorded on November 5th of this year. So this is Charlie Melcher and Claire Wardle.
But from the earliest days of the written word, there's always been misleading information, people putting out propaganda. What makes it so much worse or toxic today?
So yes, it certainly isn't new. And as humans, we've always gossiped. It's a way that we connect with each other. We've always had white lies. As you say, we've always had propaganda. What we've never had is an ability for anyone to be a publisher in real time. And when they publish, the distribution mechanism means that it speeds across the globe in seconds. And we've never had a distribution platform that worked at speed. So the content itself isn't that different. We use the same techniques that everybody's always used, but it's the speed, it's the fact that all of us, unfortunately, are nodes sharing and pushing this content out. If none of us shared anything, we wouldn't have a problem.
So who do you think bears responsibility for testing the veracity of these things or helping to clear them out of our social media feeds? Is it the companies or is it the individuals?
None of this is easy, but nobody, I would say, singularly deserves the kind of responsibility on this. I think the platforms have to be more transparent about their decisions and what they're taking down. Governments need to put more pressure on the platforms to say, release the data so we can study what's happening and what's not. But also as a public, we have to say, we're part of this mess. And actually, we need to hold each other to account. And that if, you know, your crazy uncle in the family email group keeps forwarding conspiracies, like, you need to sit your uncle down and talk about what it means, this kind of just pollution, and what that means to our, you know, our public sphere.
And I think people are just not aware. I mean, if it's something that's reaffirming your filter bubble, then you don't think that's a conspiracy theory. You think that's something everyone needs to see.
So when you've kind of got a scandal-ridden White House, or you've got, you know, we've in my country, we've just gone through Brexit and there was all sorts of hoo-ha about that. And so in those environments, you know, we're still reeling from the 2008 financial crisis. You know, there's a lot of reasons why people have mistrust in institutions. And so then when that's your foundation, you layer on the kind of conspiracies and falsehoods we're seeing now. And people are like, I told you so. I told you you couldn't trust those guys in DC. And it fits into all of that. And so we can't understand the information in isolation to that kind of socioeconomic foundation that's actually feeding so many of these conspiracies.
So, you know, there are really three main sources then that can help with this information pollution problem. The social media platforms themselves, such as Facebook and Twitter. And we've seen after yesterday, both Facebook and Twitter have taken some steps to clean up some of the misinformation and disinformation. And so that's one source. But it takes a lot of coaxing to get those social media platforms to do that, because their business model is to keep as many people happy and posting and on their site as they can. The second entity is government regulation with government policies. And that is very, very slow. You got to convince a lot of people in the government. There's a lot of negotiation that goes on with that, and there's a lot of lobby against it. But government regulation is another entity. And the third is us, the consumers. So here's Claire Wardle again, this time from a podcast hosted by University of Oregon journalism professor Damian Radcliffe as part of what's called the Demystifying Media series. It was published in 2016. So here's Damian Radcliffe and Claire Wardle.
And would you like to see the platforms doing more? What are they not doing? And where does the responsibility lie between them as the distributors of a lot of this content versus us as the consumers, and the responsibility we need to take amongst ourselves for just being more critical consumers of information?
So absolutely, that there isn't one body that can solve this. It shouldn't be all on the platforms, all on government, all on us. It should be everybody. But the challenge is, if we're all going to be involved, then we need to get more from the platforms to understand what's happening. So we started this podcast talking about when reporters should report on something. Well, if reporters don't know how far something has spread on Facebook or YouTube, and they don't know how many people have seen something, they don't necessarily have the full information about whether or not they should report on it. So the absence of us recognizing that spread, it's an opaque system that we don't have the data to make proper decisions about what to study, what to report on, the impact on society. We can't really tell whether or not disinformation impacted the 2016 election, because we're not sitting on the data that Facebook is sitting on. So there is a lot more they can do. But also, we need to realize that if we didn't share this stuff, we wouldn't have a problem. This stuff is effective because we've been weaponized, and our, unfortunately, lizard brains, if we see content that reinforces our worldview, as humans, we want to feel like I was right. And you want to share the fact that you were right. And so the most effective agents of disinformation play on our emotions and our fears, and that works. So until we all realize that what looks like a random share while you're standing in line for a coffee actually adds up to a really polluted information ecosystem, this will continue. And we're a huge part of that. And I don't think we as a society have recognized our role in all of this.
You know, thinking back to when the pandemic first started, I optimistically imagined that since it was a threat to all of us humans, and with accurate science-based information being so crucial, that the virus would bring us together and that we'd all be on the same page, fighting the valiant fight against the virus, fighting against misinformation, kumbaya. But the pandemic has pollinated a whole new weed patch of misinformation, disinformation, and conspiracy theories. Here's Claire Wardle, this time with another superhero of mine, fighting disinformation. His name is Tristan Harris. He's the co-founder and president of the Center for Humane Technology. And he's interviewing her on his podcast that's called Your Undivided Attention.
I'm actually kind of hopeful in this weird way with coronavirus, where we've been in this low trust, amusement driven world. Well, you better bet people are going to suddenly be concerned with what's actually true when it comes to the health of your family.
Yep. Disinformation works if it taps into fears about your own safety and those of the people that you love. And so on this, that's exactly, you can dismiss all this political nonsense, but this is about real harm. You touched a little bit on emotional skepticism, and there are great media literacy programs, and there's a lot of money that's gone into, oh my God, we've got to like teach the 13-year-olds. I think we know now that actually some great research from NYU, it's actually over 60 that are the biggest problem. But I wish that we could do more to teach people how to talk to one another about this. So we talk about this in training, but for example, if I, you know, go home for Thanksgiving and I'm like, hey, Uncle Bob, couldn't help but notice, posted something on Facebook, it's wrong. And here's a Snopes article that proves that you're wrong.
Doesn't work so well.
No, and we know there's psychological like worldview theory, which is like you double down on your worldview.
People feel great when people tell them that your identity is wrong.
Yeah, turns out. So we talk in training about how actually like, hey, Bob, couldn't help but notice you posted that. But I've been thinking a lot about this. Like, why are people trying to manipulate our communities? Like, I'm watching this happen. Like, people are trying to divide us. Like, what do you think? Why are people doing this, Bob? And I know that's a very simple explanation, but the language of we and us is not the language that journalists and fact checkers and researchers like to use. But that, like, we have to be better at teaching one another how to slow it down, how to get people to take responsibility for the information they share. I mean, you and I have been talking for how long now? We haven't talked about people, the users, and how we are being weaponized. And so we can add flags to Facebook and add more label, all the rest. But actually, if we don't stop my mum or whatever sharing it, then we're in trouble. And we don't talk about that at all. And so teaching people how to reverse image search a picture, yes, fine. How to read a headline, fine. But we haven't talked about the psychology of us.
Right.
And we should be doing more of that.
Well, you know, as bad as it is now, there's a scenario out there claiming it could get a lot worse and citing a future possible scenario for us that would be like fake news on steroids, using something that's called deep fakes, which are created with artificial intelligence, and they're already here. Presently on the internet, you can view some examples of deep fake videos of President Obama, Vladimir Putin, and even Mark Zuckerberg saying some pretty amazing things. Deep fakes are a type of synthetic media that could be just audio. It could be video with audio that look and sound just like a real person, but they're totally fabricated to say anything or do anything that the person creating them wants them to say or do. And in her book, it's a recent book that I read and enjoyed, called Deep Fakes, The Coming Infocalypse. You got it right. Information Apocalypse, Infocalypse, that political consultant, journalist, and author Dina Schick wrote. And it sounds an advance warning about the threat of deep fakes. From an interview that was done by former Democratic candidate Andrew Yang, who has his own podcast called Yang Speaks, he's interviewing Nina Schick. Here's Andrew and Nina.
We're entering an age where anybody can be an influencer, which can be used for good, but it can also be used for bad. And with synthetic media, it means that anybody can actually alter your perception of the world. So you can get very philosophical about it. But it is, I think, again, my book is just to lay it out, to put it in a conceptual framework, to say this is what's happening, because I think the first step is understanding. And then only can we start really talking about technical policy and society-wide solutions. And this is where I hope someone like you will take this into on your platform into the public sphere, because I think it is one of the most critical issues of the next decade. Well, the next few years, really.
Well, to understand how Nina Schick got concerned about the threat from deepfakes, Andrew Yang asked her this question.
So how did you come to become an expert on AI and deepfakes? Because most of us know that they exist, but we haven't spent years studying them the way that you have.
Well, Andrew, my background really is in geopolitics and information warfare. So I come at it from a kind of national security angle. And I've spent the last decade really working at the heart of some of the huge political events in Europe and across the pond in the United States, looking at kind of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, what's happened around the Brexit vote, what happened in 2016 with the US election, and increasingly been starting to see how the information ecosystem is corroding to the extent that the age of information, which has been around for the last few decades, really has become the age of disinformation. It's dominated by bad information. And this was something that we saw state actors taking advantage of in the past few years, but increasingly also something that, you know, influencers and lone politicians are using to their own benefit, not to mention the president of the United States. So when the kind of recent emergence of the AI community in the form of deepfakes started to come out in the last 2.5 years, it was like, oh my goodness, this is the most potent disinformation tool that is about to hit. We've been terrible at handling the corrosion of our information ecosystem for the past 10 years. We are not ready for the age of synthetic media. So that's really how I came to it from a kind of geopolitical angle, but it's far, far broader than that. And it's pervasive in every aspect of life. Synthetic media is the next step in the evolution of tampering with media, because what synthetic media is media. So it could be an image, a video, or a piece of audio that is wholly or partially generated by AI. And what that means is it's going to make it easier than ever before to create high fidelity fake video, audio, and images at a scale that we have not seen until this point.
Well, the scary thing about deepfakes is that AI, artificial intelligence software to produce them, is already available. And you don't have to be a computer geek or a graphics expert to use it. Here's Nina Shaikh again, telling how it actually works.
Basically, AI is getting sophisticated enough to hijack your biometrics. So I take my AI machine learning system and I feed it training data, which in this instance, if I want to emulate you, Andrew, I can take a clip of your voice. You would be an easy person to deepfake because of your public profile. I could just go on the internet, find a bunch of videos, find a bunch of audio clips, feed that into my machine learning system so the AI can be trained to emulate your voice, your likeness, and then I can make fake audio clips of you, or I can make fake video clips of you saying or doing anything. And because this technology really is still so nascent, we're only at the very beginning, it's getting better so much quicker than, it's getting better so quickly that soon, it's not even people who are only in the public eye, but anybody. So if there's a 5-second clip of you, there's a video of you on Facebook, anywhere on the internet, you also are fair game. So it's not only celebrities or politicians who are in the firing line, it's really everybody. And you already see that because in the first use case, non-consensual pornography, normal women are already being targeted. So when you see what's happening in porn, it doesn't take much to realize how that's going to percolate into politics. It's going to shape geopolitics, and it's also going to be something that every private citizen and every business needs to mitigate against.
Well, I'm going to play one more clip from that Yang Shaikh interview. So here's this last clip from Andrew Yang, Nina Shaikh, and here she describes how deepfakes will make something called the liar's dividend easy to claim.
I would say that because we're just at the start of this synthetic media revolution, like we haven't actually come to the stage yet where it's ubiquitous. But in 4 years' time, when it is time for the next election, some experts who I speak to think that as much as 90% of video content online could be synthetic. There is an urgency, which isn't, so it hasn't hit us yet, but in 4 years' time, we're looking at something completely different. I actually think this election is more likely to be disrupted by something called the liar's dividend. Because if we live in a world, Andrew, where anything can be faked, right? Including video, which we tend to see as authentic, right? Which is why video evidence in court is so powerful. If everything can be faked, then everything can also be denied. And that is something called the liar's dividend. And you already see that happening now. And this is something that's only going to get more potent as time goes on. There's actually one candidate, a Republican candidate standing for Congress, who took the George Floyd video, that powerful video, which unleashed a movement not only across the US, but across the world. And she's written a 24-page document saying that it's a deepfake. So you're going to see a lot more of that.
Good time to talk about altered realities, how we have completely different realities, different ideas about what's true and what's not true, completely 180 degrees out from each other. And we're sitting around wondering, how could they believe that? And they're sitting around wondering, how could we believe that? So at any rate, I do believe that when deep fakes are perfected and are widely weaponized politically, which they will be, that there is a possible threat that the worst case scenario, that is, that we could sink into a deep epistemic crisis state. Okay, epistemic is a highfalutin word, which means how we actually arrive at what is true, at how we arrive at knowledge, what do we use to figure out what the world's like and what's true. Once we enter that crisis state, it could devolve into a state where we no longer can tell what's real and what's fake, so that we just give up entirely on the ability to tell the truth from fiction, and the truth becomes anything that we want it to be. But I'm a whole lot more optimistic than that. If I didn't think there was any hope, I wouldn't be doing this show about critical thinking. So here's my scenario. I think there's no question in my mind that truth-seeking has been made worse by President Trump's style of communication, resulting in a much-publicized milestone of Trump falsehoods by the Washington Post. And the Post wrote that as of July 9th, 2020, while in office, President Trump has made 20,000 false or misleading claims, and that Post article motivated a number of walls and murals to be constructed that displayed those falsehoods documented by the Post. But it's a bit naive to think now that Trump is no longer president that the information pollution is going to drastically decrease and our information streams will clear and be sparkling clean, with Trump getting 46.8% of the vote cast to Biden's 51.3, it seems clear that Trump is going to have some vocal supporters after he's out of office who are going to continue to express that there was widespread fraud in the election or other unfounded claims and conspiracy theories. Now, a lot of Trump supporters will have their own point of view about the kind of society that they would live in. And that's all fair game. That's a difference in values. But the idea is to check and vet our information that we're getting and subject it to some deliberative system to thinking. So anyway, I believe that the majority of those who voted for Trump share a lot of the basic values in common with those who didn't vote for President Trump. But presently, there's just a staggering amount of pressure for social change that we're all working through. And in my view, we're experiencing growing pains. There is so much pressure for cultural change. Now, it is change that I personally endorse mostly, but it is not endorsed by some other people. That's really the schism between liberals and progressives and conservatives. And that social change is exerting pressures on people, and it's making us a little crazy. And I think it's scary, and it can lead to aggressive behavior, fearful behavior. It can lead to a whole lot of irrational thinking and ideas about the way the world is and things like that. But I really, when I take a step back and disengage my emotions somewhat, I think it's to be expected. I think it's a phase. I think it's something we have to go through. And that as long as we have good intentions, we try to engage with each other and not dehumanize each other, that we're going to get through this. Because there's a lot of smart and innovative and motivated folks that are working to understand and to create paths to constructively work through these issues. And on this show, we're going to continue to shine a light on those folks and continue to encourage all of us to learn and practice critical thinking skills. The other day, I heard somebody say, people have a right to their opinion, and that one person's opinion is as good as another person's opinion. And there was something that really bothered me about that. Actually, it sounds pretty good. It sounds like you're being accepted and respectful when you say something like that. But then when I think about it, some opinions are really just more supportable by evidence than others. So maybe it depends on whether the person giving the opinion is claiming that theirs is fact and should be believed. This is something I think we all struggle for. It's an interesting question to me. How tolerant should we be of opinions that we believe are BS? Maybe we'll get an answer next episode of Thinking Clearly, actually, on February 4th, when Julie and I are going to talk with Thinking Clearly guest Jevon West. He's a co-author of a book called Calling BS, The Art of Skepticism in a Data-Driven World. And he's a return guest. We did have him one other time talking about the scientific method on a previous episode of Thinking Clearly. Now, the title of his book and the title of the class that he teaches at the University of Washington spells BS out. We can't spell it out on the air because of FCC requires us to abbreviate that word. So we will next month. But anyway, that's something to look forward to. Jevon West next month, next edition of Thinking Clearly. So I'm going to just finish up on this episode of Thinking Clearly by reviewing a little bit of what our definition of critical thinking is. We haven't done that for a while. There's several parts to it. The first part is just the nuts and bolts part of what critical thinking is. And it goes like this. Critical thinking is a mode of thinking that uses the process of logical reasoning based on a thorough examination and evaluation of a robust cross-section of evidence relevant to the issue at hand when forming claims, conclusions, opinions, and beliefs. Now, the common definition of opinions is that that's why we can say everybody's entitled to their opinion. Many people's opinions are not based on evidence. So that's a personal choice. You can have an opinion that is not based on evidence. I think it's much better to have opinions that are based on evidence and beliefs, for sure, that are based on evidence, because our beliefs guide our behavior and our claims are what we communicate to other people. So critical thinking engages our system to thinking. It requires sometimes that we look things up, that we even read technical papers maybe, that we go beyond the headlines, that we dig out information, that we subject the information to some sort of tests, that we try to create a logically constructed argument that connects our evidence to our logical conclusions. And we did in a couple episodes, recent episodes, introduce on this show a system to vet information that gets into that. And again, that's posted on our website, vetting information. And the longer part of our definition has to do with attitudes. Critical thinking also includes an awareness of, an attempt to compensate for the vulnerabilities that we all have in our thought processes, including cognitive biases such as confirmation bias. And critical thinking is the most effective when there's a basic understanding of the scientific method, a certain amount of basic literacy in content areas related to those issues that we're examining, and the willingness to be a lifelong learner. And the last part is when communicating our ideas using critical thinking, we're willing to acknowledge and evaluate evidence that may be contrary to our conclusions and consider alternative conclusions and beliefs. So that's a wrap for this edition of Thinking Clearly. And I do want to thank our wonderful engineer, Sue Maloney. So until next time, keep thinking clearly.
This program was produced in KMUD's Redway Studio and is provided courtesy of KMUD, Redwood Community Radio.